This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place, whether you're in the mood for a musical love story, an exhibit featuring an emperor, or an evening of chamber music. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Award-winning producer, writer, director, and choreographer Nancy Gregory has developed a host of world-class projects that include several Super Bowls, NFL halftime shows, Broadway productions, award-winning TV shows, and so much more. Her latest work, Jambalaya, the musical, takes us down the bayou to the heart of Acadiana. Nancy Gregory joins us by phone. Hello.
Hi.
This musical sounds like spicy fun. Tell us, how did a multi-talented executive from Los Angeles find herself down the bayou in Cajun country?
Well, it's sort of a funny story. It actually started about 11 years ago. My brother, very brilliantly, married a wonderful lady from Lafayette, a Cajun gal. And so I used to hear all these stories about the culture there and, you know, all the different aspects of that culture, and I was fascinated by it, and she was, you know, very colorful, wonderful girl. And so about 11 years ago, I thought, you know, that might be a really interesting thing to write a musical about. So I went down to Lafayette by myself for 3 weeks and just talked to everybody and worked with the university, went to all the Zydeco clubs, listened to all the music, and I came out of it saying, oh my gosh, this has got to be turned into a musical. So I went back to my home and I sat there and wrote an outline, and then Katrina hit. And I realized that was the wrong time to be trying to do this. So 10 years went by, and I was speaking to somebody about it, saying that was the one thing I wish I had written. I've written many shows, and I thought, that would have been such a great show. And they said, write the book. So I did. And here we are, about to open in New Orleans.
Wow. So what will we experience?
The premise of this really is that everybody come to it, have a great time, laugh a lot, listen to some music, hear this storyline that goes through it about love, because it really is about love of the culture. It is about the generation that have, you know, been experiencing this, grew up there and know everything about the background of this world. And then we have millennials who are the new generation of people who live on the bayou. But it's a love story about a grandfather and his son, a boy and a girl who are in love. And there's a lot of mysticism in it. There's some superstitions. It's a wonderful mix, I believe, of the younger generation, what their dreams are, and what the older ones' dreams are. I wrote a story that we could have fun with.
But I'm sensing there's a subplot here.
Yes, there's a few subplots. The subplot is basically about the grandson, who's 21 years old, who has his own dreams, and he's debating whether to leave the bayou and all the tradition that he's grown up with, his grandfather raised him, or go for his dreams or stay there. But he's in love with a girl and on the bayou, and the grandfather has his friends and doesn't want him to leave but wants him to pursue his dreams.
Tell us about the musical team. You have a powerhouse of talent.
Yeah, I do. Well, you know, I've worked with a lot of these people, so they wanted to get into it. Jeff Barry is a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame songwriter. He's written a few hits you may know, everything from Be My Baby, Going to the Chapel, Do-Wah-Diddy, to River Deep, Mountain High. He's got 50 of the biggest hits that we've ever known. And at the time that I talked to him about this, he was producing a gentleman named Joseph Gordon, who is from Louisiana, from Opelousas. He was producing his new album. So we already were on the same path because he was fascinated by the culture and the music, too. So he's written a lot of original songs, and we have other people involved, too, who have written. And how this really started is Joe Stewart, a gentleman who is from Lafayette. He lives in Los Angeles, got a home in Lafayette as well, but he grew up there. I think he's won 24 Emmys. He's a production designer, and he's designed the show. So we have a few really terrific people involved.
And the cast?
Wayne Gonsolin is playing my main character, Boudreaux. We've got 7/8 now of the cast live in New Orleans and work and do theater there. So, you know, these are all people that this is their background. This is their history. One of the performers said, what I love about doing the show is that this is really about us. It really is about us, not a caricature of it. It's about us.
Now, while Cajun country is highlighted in the musical, what is the universal thread or message that connects us all?
You know, in every society, you have, you know, people who've lived there their whole lives, and they've brought up their people. So the older group in the show doesn't want their culture to get lost. It's really important that they sustain it and the traditions and everything about it. And, of course, you know, this culture is so incredibly unique and interesting. And then there's the young ones, like in every society, that want to, you know, we've all done it. We've all ran off to pursue our dreams. And where does that come together? And in this show, it does come together when the grandson realizes he can have his dreams. He doesn't have to go somewhere else to pursue what he wants. He wants to be a songwriter. So the older and the younger team up to make certain that everybody knows that this is the most important thing, family, tradition, love.
Nancy Gregory, creator of Jambalaya, the musical. Thanks.
Thank you. It's wonderful talking to you.
Save the date. Jambalaya, the musical, premieres November 30th at the Orpheum Theater. Performances continue December 1st through 3rd and 21st through 23rd. There's a new exhibit in New Orleans marking the historical and artistic endeavors of Napoleon Bonaparte. It features objects Napoleon owned himself and the new age of decorative art he inspired. Eileen Fleming stopped by the M.S. Rao Antique Shop for a tour with owner Bill Rao and exhibit curator Amanda Wallach.
We are here in Rao's Antiques in the new Bonaparte show that runs through the holiday season, and I'm with Bill Rao. Tell me, how did the show come about?
This is by far the most important and the best one we've ever done.
Is there something about Napoleon that touches you?
A client of mine asked me about Napoleon's importance. And I went on Google and I put Napoleon important. And it was interesting. The very first thing that comes up was a Time magazine article written in 2013, The 100 Most Important People in the History of the World. Number one, Jesus Christ. Number two, Napoleon Bonaparte. The world was a vastly different place pre him and post him.
We're here in the second floor exhibit. And why don't you show me what you think, Bill, is one of the most important pieces?
Well, we're standing in front of Napoleon's coronation painting. And it's amazing because every single part of this was choreographed. It's a giant painting. It's roughly 8 feet high by 4.5 feet wide. It was meant for propaganda. It was meant to show his power. And this is Napoleon really at the height of his power in 1804 when he's in his coronation robes with his crown. And every bit of the painting is choreographed to show why he's so important. But what's particularly nice about this painting is this was his favorite coronation painting. He had three artists do coronation paintings. This was his favorite.
Now here we have, in a glass case, the Emperor Napoleon's sword captured 1815. Tell me about this.
This was Napoleon's sword. It's gold-handled. One might look at a lot of swords and think they're gold-handled, but they're usually gold-plate. Gold-handled swords, there may be 100 of them in the world, maybe 60, 50, I don't know, very few. This was Napoleon's gold sword. But it's more than that. After Napoleon lost the Battle of Waterloo, Wellington went on to his home in St. Cloud and took the sword. And this is the sword that Wellington wore when he entered into Paris, captured Paris, and it proclaimed himself victor over the French.
It's the ultimate loot.
Well, it really is the vanquished sword. What else could be better?
So This is one lovely piece of furniture, but I know that there's more to the story than that.
This is Napoleon's desk that he used on St. Helene. He loses the Battle of Waterloo, and he gets sent to St. Helene, which is an island in the middle of nowhere in the Atlantic. And the Prince Regent decrees that Napoleon should have glorious objects, but nothing that would remind him of his former glory. So in other words, very well-made pieces, exceptionally well-made objects, but nothing that spoke of grandeur. So this is a desk that stood in his bedroom in Longwood House, and one would presume there's ink stains on the top. One would presume that Napoleon's, this is old Napoleon's ink stains as he penned his memoirs or he penned his last will and testament. And he probably spent more time with this single piece of furniture in his entire life than he did in anything with saving his bed. He was 6 years with this desk in his bedroom, and it's just an extraordinary piece to find something that has an unbroken history. It's pictured in a number of books. It's been in exhibitions. This extraordinary piece of furniture, that Napoleon's desk, it just doesn't get any better than this.
Bill Rau, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Amanda, we're going to talk about this little toy guillotine. What is this piece? Is this a toy or is this a joke for Napoleon? What?
It's not a toy. This is actually a guillotine that's made of bone. And this was made by a French prisoner of war who would have been held in an English prisoner of war camp. So if anyone knows anything about Napoleon, it's that he loved his conquest. And an unfortunate side effect of that was that a lot of his soldiers were taken prisoner of war by the British. They had a lot of time on their hands, and you can kind of see that in the craftsmanship. But this guillotine, like you said, it's a very humorous rendition of kind of a grotesque period in French history. It actually has a moving guillotine blade. All the little figures move. And there are actually some unfortunate souls who are eternally decapitated on the guillotine itself. But just beautifully, beautifully done, incredibly intricate work.
There are two little bloody heads in the little bloody baskets underneath the guillotine.
There are, poor guys. But these things, the more intricate, the better, because the French prisoners would then take these and sell them in order to get extra money for food and for necessities of life while they were in camp. So the better craftsman you were, the better models you could make such as this, the more you got in return.
There's a lot of Egyptian palm tree kind of motif things. Talk about that and why he enjoyed that so much.
A lot of the show talks about the iconography of Napoleon. Not only are we trying to tell a story, but we're trying to unearth how he portrayed himself. You see numerous Egyptian motifs that point to his successes with the Egyptian campaign. It's a way of bolstering himself. And then throughout his empire, you see all these imperial motifs. So in the end here, we come to the end of his life, and you see those motifs still. This nephrite carving is actually a fanciful rendition of what one of his loyal supporters would have thought his tomb would look like. So when he died on the island of St. Helena, very few people were able to visit his tomb, and it was very unadorned. So they had to come up with these imaginative renderings of what his tomb would have looked like. And this would have been carved out of nephrite, a very precious stone, carved just a few years after his death. And on it you see a lot of those imperial motifs that Napoleon cultivated throughout his lifetime. This is really cute, though, too, because you lift up this lid, and within the tomb you see a little carving of Napoleon himself. And
there he is, a little tiny 3-inch tall Napoleon in marble.
So a much grander tomb than Napoleon had during his lifetime.
Speaking of death, let's take a look at that death mask.
This was a death mask that was taken by his personal physician while he was on St. Helene. It was done 1.5 days after his death. This offers a really fascinating view of Napoleon the man.
Napoleon is every man.
He is, yes, in this moment in death. I mean, he really is just like anyone else. He's a man, myth, and a legend right here at the end in the flesh.
Amanda Wallach, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eileen. It's a pleasure.
Napoleon, general, emperor, legend, runs through January 7th at M.S. Rau Antiques at 630 Royal Street in the French Quarter. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. The New Orleans Friends of Music welcomes the internationally acclaimed Finkel-Hans Setzer Trio performing an evening of Beethoven piano trios at Tulane's Dixon Hall. We caught up with the trio's renowned cellist, David Finkel, by phone. David, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's so nice to be with you today.
It's great to have you back in the city. You and your wife, pianist Wuhan, will be joining violinist Philip Setzer, whom you played with for years as a member of the Emerson String Quartet. Is this the first time that you're performing in this configuration here in New Orleans?
It's fairly safe to say that pretty much everywhere we've played, especially in America, with the quartet and as a duo, we've also brought the trio.
So tell me, how was the trio formed?
Well, we actually played trios together, me and Phil, with another pianist before I joined the Emerson Quartet. And we always loved playing together. And, of course, we love that repertoire. It's a different kettle of fish than string quartets. You know, you have a piano and great, great music. And we love playing that music. It really spotlights the cello in a way that the string quartet doesn't quite. I love doing it. It's very challenging. And then when Wuhan came along into my life as a collaborator, it seemed very natural that we should reconstitute this trio idea with her and with Philip.
So tell us about the All Beethoven program. What will you play?
Well, Beethoven, very fortunately for us, composed a lot of chamber music. He wrote 16 string quartets, and he wrote 6 really great piano trios and then some smaller variations and other pieces for piano trio. But the Beethoven cycle of piano trios is a great thing because it spans much of his creative life, from his early period, as we call it, to the late period. And within that time, you hear quite a change in his musical personality. We begin the program with what is known as his Opus 1. It was the first works that he decided to have professionally published back in 1795, only a few years after he had moved to Vienna to make a career. And with the 3 trios of Opus 1, he really made a statement. Here I am. I'm really great. Listen to this. And it's interesting that he chose a chamber music piece to make that statement with. It just shows how important chamber music was as a measure of a composer's ability in those days, as it is now, by the way. So the Opus 1 trio, the number one that we play, is brimming with optimism and, I would say, almost aggressive virtuosity. He was out to take Vienna by storm, and he put all of his ingenuity and virtuosity and adventurousness and his signature unpredictable Beethoven personality into this first piece. So it's a very exciting way to start the concert in a very friendly and fun way. The second piece on the program was written at the height of what we call his heroic period. This is mid-1810s, about probably 1806-7-8. It's Opus 70, written in the midst of an incredible number of masterpieces, like the Violin Concerto, the 5th Piano Concerto, the 7th Symphony, etc., etc., all composed around that time when Beethoven had found a kind of a new voice as a composer of heroic proportions and intent. Probably the easiest landmark there is his Eroica Symphony of 1803, where he lengthened the symphony to an hour long, first time that had ever been done. Well, his chamber music pieces of that time also have this big, heroic, noble bent to them. And this piece, which is nicknamed the Ghost Trio because of its really scary slow movement, it's not a long piece, but it certainly is brimming with a new kind of life and vision from Beethoven that would lead eventually to his sublime late period. And then finally, the program finishes with his final piano trio, nicknamed the Archduke because it was dedicated to Archduke Rudolf, who was his piano student and patron, by the way. It's a big, noble work that has a sublime slow movement, a set of variations that really feels like you're almost putting your foot into the next world. It's a transcendent work, the kind that only Beethoven ever wrote. And even though it comes in his years well before his official late period, it's a kind of a harbinger of the really amazing music that he would write towards the end of his life.
It sounds like a wonderful program.
Well, it's a journey.
Now, you are wearing several hats these days. How are you and Wuhan continuing to grow chamber music audiences as artistic directors of the Chamber Music Society at Lincoln Center?
We have expanded the number of concerts and activities that we do in New York at Lincoln Center, but also greatly outside of Lincoln Center on tours nationally and internationally, and by means of what we call satellite series or residencies, where the Chamber Music Society has been invited to come to a city and basically curate a whole season of chamber music concerts. We have so many musicians, 60 or 70 musicians performing with us in New York every year. They're from all over the world, by the way, and they comprise individuals, soloists, string quartets, different kinds of ensembles. So we have a huge stockpile of musicians. In my database, there's between 4,000 and 5,000 pieces of chamber music worth hearing. So we have a huge amount of quality product at the very, very top of that spectrum. And it makes us able to design for a city, for a series somewhere, a varied series of programs over a year, whether it's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, that really satisfies audiences. So these are multi-year commitments to us from various cities. So it's very satisfying and exciting to see what the effect of simply playing great chamber music at the highest level can do all by itself in a city, in a place that is able to welcome us. And to see that continue and to pass to the hands of the next generation of players, which, by the way, is unbelievably strong and exciting and wonderful. If I can call that part of my legacy, I'll be very proud.
Cellist David Finkel, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I can't wait to get there.
New Orleans Friends of Music presents the Finkel-Hahn-Setzer Trio in concert Monday, November 28th at Tulane's Dixon Hall, 8 p.m. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. Wishing you and yours a happy Thanksgiving. I'm Diane Mack.